text and get engaged. And I just wonder what, you've started to say it, but what would you say to folks who want to take a next step?
Yeah, and thank you for these sorts of questions. I want to first acknowledge the fact that even as we were speaking today, only a couple of hours ago, a residential building in Beit Lahia was struck, right, and over 30 people were killed, right? And this is right next to a hospital that has already been deprived of receiving life-saving aid to keep people alive. It doesn't have enough units in the hospital to keep newborn babies alive. The reality is that this report and everything we've just spoken of on this segment today isn't a part of the past. It's a part of what is continuing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a reminder to us that this matter is urgent and needs to be addressed immediately. And I think that folks, you know, as we're entering the holidays, as we're entering the end of the year, people just want to turn a blind eye and forget the fact that this is continuing. But it is continuing, and it will intensify the more we look away. And so for anyone, recognize the fact that even your U.S. tax dollars are being paid to invest in this genocide. So what are you going to do about it? We have toolkits and resources to help make people more aware as to how that money is being invested in this genocide. And there are opportunities and avenues to actually divest from this money from continuing to fund this genocide. There are avenues out there, and we really hope folks can check out our website to figure out ways in which you can get involved in that divestment piece. If you are someone who cares enough about changing the stance the U.S. Congress has on this, as we know that they have continued to send military aid, even as President Biden closes his legacy out, he is choosing to still send weapons and funding to Israel to continue committing this genocide. What are you going to do about it? So we ask both people that are part of the civil society here in the U.S. to ask their elected officials to stop sending weapons and to be public around choosing not to continue sending weapons, even into the Trump administration. We ask folks to continue doing that. There are so many avenues in which we can actually play a role as to stopping this from happening, whether it's even putting this, you know, report out in front of your families across the holidays. We really encourage folks to use this as an opportunity to convince even more people in their surroundings to acknowledge just what's going on and to remind ourselves that Gaza in particular right now in this moment really does need the help to stop this from continuing to happen. And we in the U.S. play a huge role in making sure that we're not complicit in this genocide. So people have a positionality that they can take, and there's a moral choice here still. And we really hope that folks can continue doing everything that they can to get this to stop, because there is an opportunity for us to really make this stop.
We've been speaking with Iman Abid from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. You can find their work and their resources online at uscpr.org. Thank you so much, Iman Abid, for joining us this week on Counterspin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades of shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. FAIR.org is also the place to show much needed support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined, and we thank you. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, few corporations have changed the U.S. business and consumer model more than Amazon. So when that corporate behemoth buys one of the country's national papers, it's a conflict writ large. But things as they are, reporting on Amazon has, in general, looked more like representing that conflict than confronting it. Good Jobs First monitors mega companies like Amazon and their impact on our lives. Their database notes more than $2.4 billion in misconduct penalties for Amazon since 2010. The most expensive of those fines are about the company's anti-competitive practices, but the most frequent offenses are related to cheating workers out of wages and jeopardizing their health and safety. Arlene Martinez is Deputy Executive Director and Communications Director at Good Jobs First. We'll talk to her about the effort to make Amazon pay. Also on the show, a few years back, Amazon dangled the prospect of locating a headquarters in New York City, and the city offered some $3 billion of tax breaks and subsidies to entice them. The deal fell through for various reasons, one of which was informed community.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The death penalty is not in keeping with who we are as the United States. We are better than that. Thank you, President Biden, for following your faith and standing up for justice.
In a historic move, President Biden spares the lives of almost all 37 of 40 men on death row Monday by commuting their sentences to life without parole, just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House with a promise to restart and expand federal executions. We'll speak to two activists leading the call to abolish the death penalty, Sister Simone Campbell and Herman Lindsay, who spent 3 years on Florida death row before being exonerated. He's now executive director of Witness to Innocence. Then to the damning House Ethics Report on former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, Trump's first pick for attorney general before he was forced to withdraw from consideration.
What struck me most was that the committee found substantial evidence that Gaetz paid thousands and thousands of dollars to women for sex and illicit drugs over a three-year period. Again, the drugs for himself, including ecstasy, marijuana, and for the women as well.
Then we look at what the toppling of the Assad regime means for the Kurds of Syria, as Turkey, Israel, and the United States all vie for greater control.
Turkey is just pushing all the buttons to exterminate Kurds from Syria and from Syria's future negotiations, from attacking to cooperating with HDS to reaching out to the world leaders to take the Syria's Kurds out of the question. Turkey is a big threat to Rojava and to northeast Syria at the moment.
We'll speak with Kurdish professor Özlem Konen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say Israel's attack the Al-Auda and the Kamel Adwan hospitals in northern Gaza while forcing wounded and sick patients to leave the Indonesian hospital in the latest assaults on Gaza's devastated health system. Israeli artillery shelled the third floor of the Al-Auda hospital while Israel detonated remote-controlled explosives just outside Kamel Adwan, which is barely functioning after repeated Israeli attacks. This is Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of Kamel Adwan, speaking on Al Jazeera.
Just now, one of the explosives planted by the Israeli army detonated. It caused a shockwave that shattered the hospital doors and windows on the west side. It also injured some of the patients and the very few medical staff left at the hospital. Roughly 20 people were hurt. A second, stronger explosion followed. It caused massive damage to the hospital's west wing, and more patients were injured. The entire west wing's doors and windows were all smashed, and the false ceiling collapsed.
At the United Nations, officials decried Israel's attacks on Gaza's health system.
The Director General of the World Health Organization said that the reports of bombardment near Kamal Adwan Hospital and orders to evacuate the hospital are deeply worrisome, adding that the hospital has been in the middle of fighting for too long and the lives of patients are at risk. OCHA reiterates that civilians and civilian infrastructure, including hospitals, must be protected.
In other news from Gaza, an Israeli drone strike Sunday targeted an aid convoy in Deir al-Balah, killing four security guards. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Monday there has been, quote, some progress in talks over a ceasefire and hostage deal. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have reportedly abducted about 100 Palestinians in raids over the past day. This comes as Palestinian Authority forces are clashing again with Palestinian militants in the Jenin refugee camp. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Palestinian police have been firing rocket-propelled grenades at armed Palestinian fighters in Jenin, where Palestinian police killed a 17-year-old on Monday. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz has publicly confirmed for the first time that Israel was behind the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in July. Katz made the comment as he threatened to target the heads of the Houthi movement in Yemen.
We will damage its strategic infrastructure, and we will behead its leaders, just as we did to Haniyeh, Sinwar, and Nasrallah in Tehran, Gaza, and Lebanon. We will do it in Hodeidah and Sana'a. Whoever will raise his hand to Israel, his hand will be severed. The IDF's long arm will harm him and will settle the score.
In recent days, the United States and Israel have both bombed targets in Yemen, while Houthi forces fired a rocket at Tel Aviv that injured 16 people. Greenland is not for sale. That's the message from Greenland's prime minister after President-elect Donald Trump said it's, quote, an absolute necessity, unquote, for the United States to own and control Greenland, which is legally part of Denmark. Greenland's prime minister said, quote, our country's sovereignty and independence are not negotiable. Greenland is ours. We are not for sale and will never be for sale. We must not lose our long struggle for freedom, he said. On Sunday, Trump also threatened to take back the Panama Canal. In news from Latin America, lawmakers in El Salvador have voted to overturn a national ban on mineral mining that had been in place since 2017. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has pushed for the mining of gold and other minerals to resume despite protests by environmentalists who warn it could lead to increased water and soil contamination. In Havana, Cuba, a massive protest was held outside the U.S. Embassy Friday to denounce U.S. sanctions, which have been in place since 1962. Former Cuban President Raul Castro, who's now 93, took part in the protest. He said the U.S. sanctions had made 2024 one of the most difficult years for Cuba. Other Cubans taking part in the protest said they fear Donald Trump will make life even harder for Cubans.
We are here just as we were 20 years ago with our commander-in-chief Fidel Castro at the front to condemn the genocidal blockade that our people have suffered for more than 66 years, and also the inclusion of Cuba on the list of terrorist states. We are not a terrorist state. The coming of President Trump next January also foresees extreme measures against Cuba, and that is why we are here, to condemn any coercive act against the people of Cuba.
The House Ethics Committee released its investigation Monday into former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, who Trump had picked to be his attorney general before the Florida politician withdrew from consideration. The report found Gaetz had paid tens of thousands of dollars for sex and drugs while in office. The report also found Gaetz had broken Florida's statutory rape law by paying a 17-year-old high school student for sex in 2017. The report was released Monday despite a lack last-ditch effort by Gates to block its release. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. We'll speak with a reporter from the Miami New Times. In other news from Congress, the family of 81-year-old Texas Republican Congress member Kay Granger has confirmed she's experiencing dementia issues. Over the weekend, the Dallas Express revealed Granger had not voted in the House since July and that she had moved into a senior living facility. In March, she stepped down as chair of the influential House Appropriations Committee. She did not run for re-election in November. Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna told the New York Times, quote, Kay Granger's long absence reveals the problem with a Congress that rewards seniority and relationships more than merit and ideas. We have a sclerotic gerontocracy, Congressman Khanna said. In labor news, Amazon's facing accusations it attempted to flood the picket line of striking workers in Queens, New York. On Saturday, water began gushing from an Amazon building close to where striking workers had gathered. One Amazon driver compared the flow of water from the building to a fire hydrant on full blast. In these times, is reporting, the Teamsters have filed a written complaint with the New York City Law Department. In other labor news, the Starbucks strike has expanded to stores in Boston, Dallas, and Portland, Oregon. As of Monday afternoon, the Starbucks strike had closed 59 Starbucks stores across the country. Naomi Martinez is a striking Starbucks worker in Burbank, California.
Starbucks workers are on strike today here in LA and the surrounding area, protesting against the outstanding unfair labor practice violations that the company has still failed to settle with our union. Additionally, our path forward that we forged with the company in February has been violated by the company for a few months now, and we will no longer accept poor bargaining and bad faith bargaining.
Missouri Governor Mike Parson is facing criticism from civil rights groups for commuting the sentence of a white police detective who was convicted of fatally shooting Cameron Lamb, a 26-year-old black man, in 2019. The detective, Eric DeVolcaner, shot and killed Lamb, who is backing his truck into his own garage. DeVolcaner was convicted and sentenced to 6 years in prison. Gwendolyn Grant, president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, said, quote, by freeing a convicted officer who unlawfully killed Cameron Lamb, a young black man, the governor has made it crystal clear that black lives do not matter in the state of Missouri under his leadership, unquote. In Atlanta, Georgia, the parents of the slain environmental activist Manuel Esteban Terán have sued three police officers who were involved in their death in 2023. The activist, known as Tortuguita, was shot 57 times when officers raided a protest encampment set up to fight the construction of a massive new police training center in Atlanta known as Cop City. The former head of the Washington, D.C. Police Intelligence Unit has been convicted on charges he tipped off far-right Proud Boys leader Henry Enrique Tarrio that a warrant was out for his arrest days before the January 6th insurrection. The police official, Shane LeMond, was found guilty of obstructing an investigation and making false statements to federal law enforcement officials. In Northern California, more than 500 residents have joined a class action lawsuit in an effort to block future U.S. military aid to Israel over Gaza. The lawsuit targets Democratic Congress members Jared Huffman and Mike Thompson. The lawsuit was filed by the group Taxpayers Against Genocide. Seth Donnelly is the group's lead organizer.
We want to go to where the source is that controls our tax dollars, and that's Congress. They have power of the purse. And our two reps in the House who voted, and that's Mike Thompson for some of the counties, and the other one is Jared Huffman for the other counties. They both voted on April 20th to send $26 billion more in military aid to Israel. And by that point, it was the evidence of genocide was overwhelming.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden spared the lives of 37 of 40 federal death row prisoners. On Monday, Biden commuted their sentences to life without parole, just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump returns to the White House with a promise to restart federal executions. In a statement, Biden said, quote, "I am more convinced than ever that we must stop the use of the death penalty at the federal level. In good conscience, I cannot stand back and let a new administration resume executions that I halted," he said. Biden campaigned in 2020 on ending the federal death penalty and directed the Justice Department to issue a moratorium on federal executions, which they did. Brian Stevenson, the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, praised Biden's decision, calling it, quote, "an important turning point in ending America's tragic and error-prone use of the death penalty," unquote. A Trump spokesperson, meanwhile, slammed the decision as abhorrent. There were 13 federal executions during Trump's first term as president. While Biden commuted the sentences of nearly all death row prisoners, there are three men who carried out mass killings who did not receive clemency. Dylann Roof, who killed nine black parishioners at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. Boston Marathon bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev, and Robert Bowers, who attacked Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, killing 11 congregants in the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. This action comes after years of advocacy by civil rights and Catholic groups. Last week, he had a phone call with Pope Francis, who reportedly called for the sentences of death row prisoners to be commuted. But for more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Sister Simone Campbell is with us. She's the former executive director of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice. She's the recipient of the 2022 Presidential Medal of Freedom. And from Miami, Florida, we're joined by Herman Lindsay, the executive director of Witness to Innocence, which advocates to end the death penalty. He was wrongfully convicted in 2006 in Florida, spent 3 years on death row before being exonerated by the Florida Supreme Court in 2009. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Herman Lindsay, let's begin with you in Florida. First, respond to what President Biden has done.
I think what President Biden has done has been a great thing. It's a great historical moment. I know three other presidents has in the past commuted a death sentence before. No one has ever done it in such a mass capacity. But I think Biden Act shows that leaders can be humane and bring humanity back in our justice system.
And Sister Simone Campbell in Washington, D.C., you campaigned for a long time on this issue as did the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice. Explain, if you understand, the decision that Biden made and what it took.
Well, I think this was President Biden putting his conscience into action, that he had said back in 2020 that he opposed the death penalty, but it has taken this long for the commutation of these sentences, mostly because he couldn't get Congress to act. That was where the roadblock is yet again, is that our country's congressional function is not working. So he had to take this move to commute the sentences. But I think the most important piece for me as a person of faith is that he shares that faith and put it into action in a pretty courageous way, to speak out about the needs of healing the criminal justice system that too often is wrong and acts on behalf of our society, that is a travesty and acts erroneously on our behalf. He took care of that for these individuals. I am so grateful for his courage in making that happen.
And Sister Campbell, can you talk about the position of the Vatican?
Well, Pope Francis has made it abundantly clear a couple of years ago in writing in the encyclical that he wanted the end of the death penalty. He started this year saying, let's this year be the year that we end the death penalty in a global way? And then his very specific conversations with President Biden about his role in being able to make a difference. I think it's a tribute to all of those who worked on this issue that the Pope was included in that campaign. His heart is the heart of life, of giving life wherever we are. And if we're pro-life, then we need to be opposing the death penalty. That's how we stand together.
On Monday, Democracy Now! Reached Cantor Michael Zusman, a former prison chaplain, co-founder of L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty. He responded to the news of Biden commuting 37 of the 40 death row sentences.
On behalf of the 3,700 plus members of L'Chaim, which means to life, L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty, we applaud President Biden for commuting and saving the lives of 37 human beings. And I can say without equivocation that we stand against the death penalty in every single case without exception. And that includes the shooter of the Tree of Life Synagogue. And that includes the others in line for state killing on federal death row and on military death row. We believe, as did Elie Wiesel, who is a Holocaust survivor and the founder in principle of our group, that no civilized society should be at the service of death. And so we believe that President Biden still has a chance to do the right thing and commute that sentence.
If you can respond, Sister Simone, to exactly what he said.
Well, I think his point that the death penalty should not exist, period, and that the three remaining federal prisoners on death row should also be commuted. Quite frankly, life is life, death is death, and we choose life as people of faith. I agree with him, but I am so relieved that 37 of the 40 have had their sentences commuted. It still is a painful reality that three remain, but that we have made progress. It's a step forward, but we have more to do, especially now at the state level. We need to extend life in all situations and make sure that we are a people that values all life.
And then you have four men in military death row, Sister Simone.
Oh, yes. I mean, the thing that was new to me in this work was how many different death rows there are. I just thought there was a federal death row that we needed to address. And then to find out that even in the military, there is a, that is allegedly for our protection, we also have four people on death row. That is a painful reality that we should not allow to continue, but it does.
Herman Lindsay, can you talk about your own life experience? You're now executive director of Witness to Innocence, which advocates for the end of the death penalty. You yourself were on death row for 3 years before being exonerated by the Florida Supreme Court. Explain what happened.
My case was one of the basic cases that happens around the world. I was a young guy that was able, he was with a criminal record that was easily to be convicted, and this case was prosecuted horrendously on me. It was based on a guy's statement who turns out to be one of the prime suspects, and the Florida Supreme Court feel like he has some actual involvement in the case. But my experience on death row was an experience of uniqueness, and it helped me grow tremendously in life and open my eyes in life, because when I first went on death row, I was scared because it was like everybody pictured them as these monster people and you know, people with big psychological problems. But when I got on death row and I actually got to know these guys and we all became like family, you know, I realized that, you know, it is rehabilitation in these people. And these people can teach a lot of people in prison a whole lot of things to help the ones that do return to the streets how to maintain and how to deal with things, especially trauma, without coming back to prison.
I think the figure is, what, 1 in 8 people on death row have been exonerated. Is that right?
Yeah, about that number. Here in Florida, it's a little bit, the number changes a little bit because we lead the nation in the most exonerations. We lead the nation with 30.
Talk about Florida, because as Sister Simone Campbell just said, there are so many death rows in the United States. But you've got the federal death penalty, and that President Biden had put a moratorium on and now has granted clemency to the men. Well, has commuted their sentences to life without parole. But then there's the death rows in which thousands of people are on throughout the United States on state death row.
And I think those death rows are used in more of a political tool. I am a firm believer that death is not a punishment. You know, I grew up when I lost a pet, when I lost a friend, my mom would tell me it's okay, they're going off to a better place. Death is not a punishment, but most politicians use that to say, to put the fear into people and use it as a voting tool. But the death penalty around the United States, it differs in each state. So when we're talking about death penalty, you have to understand that the difference is the person who's over that state. For instance, DeSantis, I wish DeSantis would commute the role in Florida, you know, but because he's running on a tough on crime case, I feel like it's hard for to get him to do that. And that's because it's a political tool, like for Trump executed them 13 people, you know, right before his elections. You know, we hadn't had execution for 17 years. It's used as a political tool. Death is not no way decreasing violence, or is no way giving anybody closure. You know, closure comes in the justice at the time that a person is apprehended. You would apprehend someone for committing the crime. That is closure to the family instead of that person running around, not the death penalty.
Can you talk about the racial disparities on death row, Herman? If you've got, in this case, of the 37 men whose sentences were commuted, 15 are white, 15 are black, 6 are Latino, and 1 is Asian. Talk about it nationwide.
Well, nationwide is different. It depends on each state. For instance, Florida is majority black. You go to Texas or California, majority is Latinos. You know, it all depends on the actual area, this actual state that you're in, that the ratio changes. But here in this situation with the federal, I think that the ratio was kind of balanced a little bit. You know, I don't see racism playing a part in that federal standard, but in the state standards, you see racism playing a part. And many different ways.
Let me ask you about the 3 men who remain on federal death row. They are Jokhar Tsarnaev, convicted in the 2013 Boston bombing, Boston Marathon bombing, Dylan Roof, who was convicted in the mass shooting of the 9 black parishioners at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. That was 2015. And Robert Bowers, who attacked Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, killing 11 Jewish worshipers in the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. Why do you believe, Herman, that they should have also had their sentences commuted?
I believe that because, you know, like I say, I believe in human life. I believe in humanity. I was reading an article where Trump said it's a slap in the face to the victim. Actually, I think by you executing them, it's a slap to the face of the victim. Because if you execute them, that relieves them from all consequences of what they have done. What people don't understand is that when you're in prison, you know, when you're in prison, you have to take time out to think about what you have done. You have to think about you can't be there for your loved ones. You have to think about is your child writing you? Are your child mad? It's so many things that you have to think about that is very traumatic to yourself when you're doing time. And to just pull them in one day, and they tried to make it where you can execute more faster, but to actually bring that person in and execute them is like relieving them from any sentence that they had imposed on them. And something to think about is this, and I like to say this, suppose that you had a loved one that got murdered, and you taught that loved one that when someone passed away, they go off to a better place, and then you turn around, you sitting at home and you're watching TV, and that person's soul come to you and say, hey, what happened to the person that killed me? And you turn around and you tell them, well, we executed him. And then the person asks you, the victim asks you, so that means you sent them off to a better place? I mean, if you actually think about it, you know, and even those that committed those horrendous crimes, I think they need to be evaluated so we can understand why they committed this, what made them trigger, so we can understand to put a resolution to preventing these type of things from happening. But just Xing them out and killing them is not the answer.
Sister Simone Campbell, finally, Trump executed more prisoners than the last 10 presidents combined when he was president. Now he promises to expand the death penalty. How is the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice and other groups responding and mobilizing for his second term?
Well, as on so many issues that need to be addressed in this second term, the mobilization is quite strong. I think it's buoyed up by President Biden's choice for life in this situation. And the fact is, there will be demonstrations. But I think what your listeners need to understand is that those 13 executions were done in the last 6 months of his presidency. And as was said, it was done as a political stunt, not as an element of the justice system. So the whole movement will continue to push at the state level and to ensure that federal law changes so we do not get in this situation again. We have to change federal law, state law, and commute the sentences at the state level. We have a lot of work to do.
Sister Simone Campbell, former head of the Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice, and Herman Lindsay, executive director of Witness to Innocence, which advocates to end the death penalty. He was convicted in 2006 on Florida death row for 3 years before being exonerated by the Florida Supreme Court in 2009. Next up, we look at the damning House Ethics Report on former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, Trump's first pick for Attorney General. Stay with us.
My father could use a little mercy now. The fruits of his labor falling right slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long. He won't be around. I love my father. He could use some mercy now.
Now by Mary Gauthier. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the damning details of the House Ethics Committee report released Monday on former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, Trump's first pick for attorney general, before Gaetz was forced to withdraw from consideration. He tried to block the report's release this week, but failed. The bipartisan committee's report found Gaetz, quote, regularly paid women for engaging in sexual activity with him, possessed illegal drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy, on, quote, multiple different occasions. The report also found Gaetz had paid a 17-year-old high school student for sex in 2017. The ethics committee also investigated a trip Gaetz made in 2018 to the Bahamas, where he accepted transportation and lodging in violation of the House rules and laws on gifts. The committee found Gaetz, quote, violated House rules, state and federal laws, and other standards of conduct prohibiting prostitution, statutory rape, illicit drug use, acceptance of impermissible gifts, the provision of special favors and privileges, and obstruction of Congress. The report has renewed questions about how Gaetz escaped federal charges after an earlier Justice Department criminal investigation. A lawyer for two women who testified before the House Ethics Panel, which is evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, two of the witnesses said they were paid for sexual favors by Gaetz, including one who said she witnessed Gaetz having sex with a minor, had called for the report to be released. Joel Leppard said in a statement, the House Ethics Committee's thorough investigation and detailed findings vindicate my client's accounts and demonstrate their credibility. Meanwhile, Gaetz continued to deny all allegations against him. He wrote on X, quote, giving funds to someone you're dating that they didn't ask for and that isn't charged for sex is now prostitution. There's a reason they did this to me in a Christmas Eve report and not in a courtroom of any kind where I could present evidence and challenge witnesses, he said. Gaetz also spoke Sunday about his future in politics at Turning Points America Fest.
My fellow Floridians have asked me to eye the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. Maybe special counsel to go after the insider trading for my former colleagues in Congress. It seems I may not have had enough support in the United States Senate. Maybe I'll just run for Marco Rubio's vacant seat in the United States Senate and join some of those folks.
Gaetz has also said he may return to Congress briefly since the special election to replace him is set for April 1st. He wrote on X he could be sworn in with the new House members in January, then file a privilege motion to, quote, expose every Me Too settlement paid using public funds of former and current members. He suggested he would then resign and head to the One America Network, where he's been hired to host his own hour-long political talk show. For more, we're joined in Miami, Florida by Naomi Feinstein, staff writer at Miami New Times. She's been reporting on Matt Gaetz. Her latest co-authored piece is headlined Former U.S. Rep. Matt Gaetz Paid 17-Year-Old for Sex, Ethics Report Found. Naomi, thanks so much for joining us. So the report found, among other things, he paid tens of thousands of dollars to women for sex. Explain exactly, as you analyze this report, what he is being accused of.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, the report is detailed. There are extensive records showing these payments from Venmo, from PayPal, from his checking account. And he had this middleman, Joel Greenberg, as we all know. He was the former tax collector of Seminole County. And he would help him arrange to meet these women via Seeking Arrangement, which is a mutual beneficial relationship website. More so, you know, colloquially, sugar babies wanting to meet sugar daddies. And so they would have these meetings, and it was pretty clear that these were for sex. And so you see in these text messages talking about payments, talking about flying to New York, flying here, flying to the Bahamas. And it's pretty clear. And the women also said they knew that, not all of them, of course, but some knew that this notion of sex and payment was expected in these relationships.
So wait, explain, so both of them were public officials.
Yeah, he was a Seminole County tax collector, ways away from us in Miami. So we don't know the ins and outs of him, you know, in terms of aside from, you know, his whole criminal indictment. He's actually currently in prison. But yeah, he was kind of like this little middleman for Matt. And he would really arrange these meets. There's text messages where he's texting with one woman asking, oh, do you have a friend? And she's like, yeah, I have a friend. And the meet would be $400. And he then sends a text, well, this is my friend, texting a picture of Matt. So you kind of see this. And he cooperated with investigators in terms of the federal investigation, but also with the House committee. He was pretty integral in giving a lot of these records, explaining how they would have these parties. Again, in July 2017, one of these parties is where Matt had sex with the 17-year-old girl. So yeah, they kind of had this kind of tandem, this little tag team of having these parties, having this arrangement to meet women.
In one text exchange, a woman complains to another woman who's also involved that she didn't receive payment from Gates. She said, I hate the money situation and drugs, she writes. The woman advises her to ask for money up front and, quote, before you have sex with him for sure. Talk about these text exchanges and talk about the significance of the House Ethics Committee releasing this report, because it meant that Republicans had to join the Democrats in agreeing to release it.
Yeah. These text messages, as you just read, are pretty explicit in terms of the details. They're talking about, again, all the drugs. He's asking for, oh, I'll pay you. Do you have cartridges for marijuana, like for marijuana pens? There's constant discussions of payment. One woman was complaining about not being paid, and he says, you only gave me a drive-by. And so there's a lot of this discussion about payment and not getting paid, again, in terms of these sexual favors. On the other front, yeah, I mean, it is shocking, I think, that they released it, given, you know, this split party line in terms of staying and also in tow with Trump, him being, you know, Gates being a Trump, fierce Trump ally. I just think the public pressure, I think, became too much. I don't know, I'm not in these meetings, but I just think it's hard to escape this. And I think there would be growing calls to release it. So I think it is shocking. But again, I think you saw the public pressure kind of almost forced him to pull out of the AG race. So I think the public pressure, again, just really forced their hand.
The report also focuses in part on a trip that Gates took to the Bahamas. Explain what this trip was.
Yeah, no, it's a very, we in our six takeaways in our article, we kind of pulled this trip out. So it was in 2018, it was Gates and two, they said, like friends, both of which are very tied in with the medical marijuana industry. Again, we don't know who they are. And they went with six women to the Bahamas. Gates flew commercial to the Bahamas, but his lodging was paid for by this medical marijuana individual, you know, tied into the industry. There was ecstasy. These women said they had sex with Gates. Their sexual activity, but on the extent of it. And in terms of, they said they weren't exactly paid for this. They said the trip itself was payment. The reason why this trip kind of, you know, got in the crosshairs, aside from his behavior, was that also on the way back from the trip, Gates went on a private plane, paid by this medical marijuana tied individual. So they found out that he had all these undisclosed gifts. The lodging was paid for, the meals were paid for. The woman said they never saw Gates pay for anything. And again, Gates flew on this private plane back. So again, these are just gifts that he's getting on the other front of besides his behavior.
So if you can talk about his role in the downfall of Kevin McCarthy, or I should say the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, attributes his downfall to Matt Gaetz, who he said wanted the Ethics Committee probe to be stopped because McCarthy didn't. He voted against him.
Yeah, I mean, he was leading the charge with getting Speaker McCarthy, you know, out. And so, yeah, and I mean, we even see at the RNC, I remember before Matt took the stage, he's there like teasing McCarthy. And yeah, Gaetz is a fierce ally of Trump. So anyone getting in their way is their enemy, and so to speak. So yeah, he will do we'll see. I mean, it's pretty clear that he would really do anything to let that, you know, more right-wing MAGA agenda in, and so McCarthy was just in his way, and so he will do what he needs to do to help Trump.
And the possibility, now he's going on to OAN, the extreme right-wing TV network, but the possibility he could run for governor of Florida or Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's teasing it. Again, we don't know with him. He's very unpredictable. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he runs for governor. You know, he's been in state politics, his dad, you know, and so they're you
what about the
him.
Power of his family, Naomi Feinstein?
Yeah, they've just been ingrained in Florida politics. He's just known around here. And so I don't think he's going away so quickly. And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he runs for governor. Again, I don't know. Again, I'm all the way down in South Florida. We're miles away from what on the ground people think of Matt Gaetz, you know, in his congressional district. So he might be electable up there. We just don't know. And it's a gauge that we will find out, but it will be very interesting, I think, how this all plays out given these accusations. But at the same time, you see already everyone on his side, Trump, you know, defending him, saying these are baseless accusations. He was exonerated by the federal investigators. So it's going to be a situation like that, likely, I'm guessing.
And how it's possible that President-elect Trump, I mean, so many of his picks are from New York and from Florida, where he now resides. And, of course, Don Gaetz, Matt Gaetz's father, longtime Florida Republican politician. Trump, the president-elect, didn't know about this House report or the thought that it could even be possibly leaked.
I know. Yeah, I thought the same thing
he picked him for attorney general. This is a man, yeah. By the way, we should be very clear on his positions, far right positions, except on the issue of marijuana for decriminalization. Is that right? But on issues, yes. On issues of reproductive rights, fiercely anti-abortion. Talked about the women who support access to abortion, too unattractive to be impregnated, that those who attend abortion rallies are, quote, ugly on the inside and out when it comes to transgender issues, when it comes to the whole debate over bathrooms. He has been fierce in his anti-trans rhetoric, also even on the issue of contraceptives.
Yeah, exactly. And so back to what you were saying about the House report, I thought the same thing. I mean, again, we would hope that Trump knew about this, but at the same time, nothing surprises me at this point, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's shocking that he did go through if he didn't exactly know this, but at the same time, if he didn't know this, that's even crazier considering there should be proper vetting. You know what I mean? There should be proper discussions about this, but it's shocking that if he knew all of this and still proceeded.
Well, Naomi Feinstein, want to thank you for being with us, staff writer at the Miami New Times. We'll link to your article, former U.S. Rep. Matt Gaetz, paid 17-year-old for sex, ethics report found. Next up, we look at the toppling of the Assad regime, what it means for the Kurds of Syria. Stay with us. Everything by Indigo Spark. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Syria and what the fall of the Assad regime means for Syria's 2 million Kurdish people, who make up about 10% of the country. Since the Islamist armed group, HDS, toppled the Assad regime, Turkey, Israel, and the United States are vying for greater control in post-Assad Syria, and the balance of power seems to be shifting against Kurdish groups. Turkey's foreign minister traveled to Damascus Sunday to meet with Syria's new de facto leader, Ahmed Ashara, the head of HTS. According to press accounts, they discussed the need for Syria to draft a new constitution, Israel's attacks on Syria, and the future of the Kurds. Meanwhile, a U.S. delegation met with Ashara on Friday, and the Biden administration's moving to lift a $10 million bounty on him over his links to Al-Qaeda. The Pentagon's also acknowledged there are now about 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, more than double previously announced figure of 900. On Monday, the Turkish president, Tayyip Erdogan, said Syrian Kurdish armed groups had no place in Syria's future, adding that Turkey would continue targeted operations against it. Turkey regards the Syrian Kurdish militia, YPG, as an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which has fought an insurgency against the Turkish state for 40 years. The Syrian Kurdish YPG is the military wing of the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, a key U.S. ally in fighting the Islamic State. But the return of President-elect Trump has called into question how long Washington's support will continue. For more, we're joined here in New York by Aslam Goneh. She's associate professor at the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the College of Staten Island at the Department of Middle Eastern Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, CUNY. She's also a steering committee member of the Emergency Committee for Rojava and is from the Bakut region of broader Kurdistan. Welcome to Democracy Now, Professor. Talk about your concerns right now. What exactly is happening to the Kurdish population of Syria?
Thank you so much for having me. So this is a big threat for the Kurdish populations in Syria, and this is also a big threat for this Democratic Confederalist Women's Liberationary and Pluralist experience that Kurds initiated in the region of North and East Syria more broadly. Because Turkey, as you've shown in the clip, and also as President Erdogan, for example, just this past week, said that we can't confine the great Turkish nation to its 700-something thousand kilometers. So Turkey is very explicitly saying that they're involved. Turkey has said very explicitly that they've been supporting HDS for 11 years and that they have a stake in Syria and have explicitly been intervening in the region, pushing for its interests, trying to further its already occupied. For example, Turkey has been occupying Afrin region of North and East Syria that was under the Kurdish self-government for now since 2018. So Turkey is a big threat to the democracy and against Kurds, especially at this moment. And we've seen in Syria, you know, both Israel and Turkey are making their progress at trying to control further territory, trying to exert further power and control in the region. And all through the U.S., Turkey is a NATO country. We have to know this because sometimes this is represented in as if there's like Turkey versus the U.S., whereas actually Turkey is one of the major allies of the United States in the region. Turkey is the second largest NATO army, and Turkey has been not only massacring, torturing, imprisoning Kurds under the Turkish territories, under the Turkish nation state, but has been killing journalists in Kurdistan, has been killing journalists in Syria, in Iraq. So Turkey is really playing at becoming a major force in this region and taking Kurds out of the picture here.
Let's talk specifically about the journalists. Press freedom groups have condemned the killing of two Kurdish journalists, Nazim Dastan and Cihan Bilgin, by a Turkish drone as they were reporting on attacks on the Tishrin Dam on the outskirts of Kobani in northern Syria. Right. Explain the significance of this area and who those journalists were.
Right. So those journalists, this is very, very important. This is crucial that Turkey target killed these two journalists in North and East Syria.
A man and a woman,
yes. So Nazım Dastan has been showing Turkey's involvement with ISIS starting in 2014 when Kobani, this town that's now under the threat of yet another Turkish invasion, and the SNA, the Turkish militias, Turkish mercenaries paid by Turkey, are at the border and have started also ground invasion. Turkey is using airstrikes and drones to also do these targeted killings. Nazım Dastan was the journalist in 2014 who showed the Turkish ISIS alliance and how the different ways that Turkey was supporting ISIS in the region. And he was actually imprisoned in Turkey prior to his killing in North and East Syria. And Cihan Bilgin has also been doing very important work showing, for example, the lives of Kurdish people who were displaced from Afrin by Turkey's ethnic cleansing in 2018. So she has been in the region reporting the lives of these displaced people and also the ongoing Turkish attacks, because we need to understand something that's very important, is that Turkey from 2014, by supporting ISIS into the killing of 14,000 Kurdish people at the hands of ISIS, backed by Turkey, was very important. Since then, in 2018, Turkey occupied Afrin, a region in northern East Syria that was under the Kurdish self-rule, and ethnically cleansed thousands of people, sold Kurdish women to slavery. And there are many, many human rights reports that show this at this moment. So 2018. 2019, Turkey again came to the UN meeting and in front of all the UN, the world leaders, showed a detailed map as to how Turkey plans to colonize and occupy the North and East Syria. So it's trying to attack Kurds. And 2023, right before Israel's genocide started in Gaza, Turkey destroyed 40 to 50% of infrastructure in North and East Syria. And these, you know, they hardly make it to the media, but these are the realities that Turkey is a major threat to Kurds and to democratic experiment that Kurds have been implementing in the region starting in 2014.
So let's talk about how this will all play out with the presidential transition here. Right. The U.S. is backing one Syrian Kurdish group that Turkey is opposed to, but at the same time, Turkey and the U.S. are allies, right?
Yes.
Both in NATO.
Yes. Yes.
And also, how worried are Kurds in Syria about President Trump returning to power? In 2019, he greenlit a Turkish invasion into northern Syria.
Right, right. I mean, as you know, these are fascist governments that are basically in coordination since the Cold War. Turkey has been one of major allies of the United States in the region, starting with the Cold War. I mean, using military training, sales of war equipment, the planes, the F-16s that kill Kurds in North and East Syria are sold by the U.S. And not only are sold by the U.S., but the U.S. actually gives a lot of military funding, humanitarian funding that are used in the purchase of these weaponry. So behind, you know, if you scratch the surface a little bit, the only purpose of those U.S. troops in the region were to prevent the further growth of ISIS. Because even prior to the U.S. entering the region, it was the Kurdish forces who have been, because of their own movement success of 40 years of practicing of self-governing, self-defense, women's self-defense forces. So these were all in place before the U.S. entered the region. But the current presence of the U.S. troops is to prevent Turkey from entering, annihilating, crushing, killing Kurds in tens of thousands. What we're seeing in Gaza today can happen in Rojava if we don't enter. And it happened previously to Kurdish populations in my hometown of Dersim, 1938, in Iraq. So the Kurdish populations, at the hands of these governments who are in cooperation with the U.S., who use U.S. funding, U.S. military equipment, and then somehow appearing on the surface as if there is some contradiction here between the U.S. and Turkey. At the moment, as you said in the beginning, Turkey, Israel, and the U.S. collectively are trying to carve out this land, and Kurds are under threat. And also, I have to say, one important thing is even during Assad regime, Turkey was preventing the Kurds from sitting at the negotiating table to determine the future of a democratic Syria. And Turkey is doing that right now. While HDS have been giving some messages that Kurds could be included in this process, that is after that the Turkish foreign minister made several visits, signaled that, hey, we've been supporting HDS for the past 11 years. And so Turkey is trying very hard to prevent Kurds from sitting at the negotiating table. And that's a very big loss for the region in general.
And, of course, we'll continue to cover this. Özlem Gunnar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Associate Professor at Department of Sociology and Anthropology at College of Staten Island, and also at the CUNY Graduate Center here in Manhattan. Happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. Tune in tomorrow to our tribute to the blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg, the man who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, his song sung by millions around the world. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Members or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're tuning into WRCT Pittsburgh, Forbes Avenue. I'm Kate Smiggy, and I'm joined by Richard Gordon and Laura Schock. And we're right here at the Phipps Botanical Gardens, and we're going to be talking about the Holiday Magic Light Show, some of the general plant information at Phipps, some of the creativity that goes into installing work, and the importance of botanical gardens in the modern age.
Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about Phipps? I've only lived here 6 years. This is the first time I've been in here.
You know, we hear that a lot. People that live here for years and years and never come here. But then there's other people that come here every year or every show. So it takes all different types to like the conservatory environment and what we have to offer for shows. This has been here since 1892. It was built in 1892 and opened up in 1893 by Henry Phipps, friends with Andrew Carnegie and all the very rich people at the beginning of the last century. And he left this to the city of Pittsburgh as a gift. So it was constructed not quite as elaborate as it is today, but it is the same structure basically for many of the rooms in the very beginning of the room.
I was curious, have the plants evolved over time in Phipps?
Yeah, we have collections rooms, and then we have changing display rooms, such as the palm court that you see here. So when you walk through, you'll see a combination of different things that are permanent, and then other ones that we change up to five times a year. So we have spring show, winter show, summer show, fall show, and orchid and bonsai show. So they're all very exciting shows that we put on. We're also very excited about all our collections, too. So we have a very extensive orchid collection, cacti collection, bonsai collection. So we like to talk about those, too, because they're pretty exciting.
We walked in here into the main entryway, and immediately I feel the humidity go up.
Yeah. Well, we water our plants all the time. So, living things, it's so nice to just take in the oxygen that you get in here. You just come in here on a winter day, and you're just, like, revived again. So, and your skin, it glows.
So how does the humidity work, or the irrigation systems? Do people manually do it, or I...
There's only a few things that are not manually watered. Everything is basically done by horticulturists in the mornings. Before guests show up, we pull out our hoses and we water what we need to water. And they go through a rotation of what needs more water and what doesn't. Just like humans, they all need different needs, so do plants.
Have there been... For instance, like during storms or such, how is that?
Yeah, we've had storms. We've had lots of storms. We've had bad storms sometimes, too. We have a skeleton crew on the weekend, and they come in and do the same things that the people during the week do. Most of our staff is here Monday through Friday, and then we have a crew on the weekends to take care of everything in the back and here. So there's another acre in the back of plants that are coming up for the next shows. And what we store, so there's a lot to take care of.
Why don't you tell us about some of the plants we can see so that our listeners can imagine and be inspired to come to Phipps?
So when you walk in the palm court, it's 60 feet high. It's like a big dome. It's like a big snow globe right now because everything's cold outside and everything's tropical inside. So there's lots of palms in here, some of them soaring up to like 40 feet high or taller. And lots of greenery in here. So this is, the palm court's a combination of our collections, our palm collection, and as you see in the middle, a changing display with our unicorns and lights and Christmas lights and poinsettias.
How long does it take to plant a show? I know you said that there was an acre of plants behind Phipps. How do you time that correctly or order the plants in time?
Well, it's